Chris, Mr. Sabani, thank you very much for coming here. You're a very nice man. I was in the attendance in the law school when you came the last time. I find it a little amazing that you can spend your whole talk on mentioning the word oil. And it seems to me, from reading the papers and studying this, that your comparison between our nation coming into existence in 1776 and the Iraqi nation right now is similar. Both are being ruled by an imperial force. How do you stand there and not talk about oil when you talk about Iraq?
Very simple. It wasn't my topic. I'll tell you, I think Iraq has been, I mean, oil has been a curse for Iraq. I wish there were a way that we could pump the oil away. One of my very close friends is the former permanent representative of Jordan to the United Nations, currently the Jordanian ambassador to the United States. And I told him I wish we could pump the oil into Jordan and let it be your problem. We had a rentier economy that allowed Saddam Hussein to remain in power. I've often told Kenan McKee that I think he got it only half right when he wrote about the Republic of Fear. The Republic of Fear came later. In the first instance, Saddam Hussein co-opted the industrial class, for instance, in Iraq, by drowning them in cash. If the import of the question is that the United States came to Iraq because of oil, and because we had oil, let me start with the astounding premise that the United States is not a legal or mercenary institution. It's not a philanthropic enterprise. It came to Iraq because it felt it had vital national interests. If that was oil, so be it. It was our only hope that the next 35 years would not be the same as the previous 35 years. If they came because of the oil, as a friend of mine's mother would say, gesunde hate. The point was that it was our only hope to remove the previous regime. Now, the oil gives us the opportunity to rebuild ourselves economically quickly. And I thought that such an obvious proposition that I didn't need to say it.
Posited the idea of reintegrating. Thank you very much.
nobody had posited the idea of reintegrating the Bakhtis as such into the new government. The Bakht party is constitutionally barred in Iraq as the Nasser party is in Germany. What we have recognized, however, is that the de-Bakhtification announced in the War of 91 by Ambassador Bremer went far too far and included people who should not have been included. There has been a bill proposed by the President and Prime Minister to take a look at that and to look at, to make distinctions between ideological and non-ideological members of the Bakht party and between those who committed crimes and those who didn't. Now, that is a bill still pending in Parliament. And as an ambassador, I don't have the luxury of being able to have a view on that bill. When it passes, I will support it, of course. Anyway, is that your question? At least as long as I am an ambassador.
Speaking as someone who is going to be an army officer very soon, will most likely be deployed to Iraq within the year, I feel like as a member of that presence, I won't be a part of the political process, but I will be one of the main points of contact for the American presence in the country. And so I'm asking you, what can myself and my colleagues do in order to aid that process, or at least to do no harm in it?
You know, I gave a talk last week at West Point, and I met a lot of, there were several young cadets who had been enlisted men in Iraq who are now cadets at West Point. It's a very difficult question for me to answer because I having never served in the military, I cannot imagine, number one, what it would be like to serve in the military, number two, to do so in the war. What I would say is that obviously it's important for all of us I'm a great believer in education, and I think it's very important for us to get to know one another much better than we can. There are some very responsible individuals in this country who unfortunately are not taking the time to learn anything about our history, and yet they feel not the slightest hesitation in opining as to how our future should go. So my admonition to you would be to get to know as much as you can about Iraq. In a real sense, you will be an ambassador yourself there on behalf of your country to the extent that you have interaction with Iraqis, that I can tell you. And at the same time, you will have a front seat to the events and ultimately, while not obviously in an active service presumptively, but at some point you will have the ability to speak authoritatively here about your experiences. So that's what I would say to you. I think it's important to get to know the subject as well as you can.
I just want to thank you for coming also. And actually, I want to read this initial partition, which I have not up for.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble understanding you. Can you slow down just a bit and maybe speak up?
Yeah, I also want to readdress the issue of partition, which I thought on earlier. I'm happy you addressed it. I want to start preface my statement with that I'm not interested so much in American interest in the Middle East. It's not my main concern. I'm Israeli, I'm born in Israel, that supersedes all American interest for me. And I was surprised how quickly you discarded the notion of partition as even an option. Any option on the table is still kind of premature to me. But I want to say that I don't see that.
Well, before we talk about that, let's talk about the partition of Israel.
Okay.
Where would you like to draw the line? I mean, you know, you've got Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardi Jews and Mizrahi Jews, and some speak Yiddish and some don't. It's just a mishmash. How do they just partition the place? You've got religious Jews and secular Jews, and it's just too much to deal with. But look, all I would say to you is, with all respect, and I'm very glad you came, and I'm not trying to be, and I realize I touched you off, so I'm going to give you this speech, and I'm going to let you go back and ask me a question in case I don't cover it. Let me deal with my country, please. You deal with your problems. Let me deal with mine. I didn't interrupt you, please.
Yeah. I think, first of all, to compare the situation with Israel, and in order to exclude the Palestinian territory, is absurd compared to Iraq. I think the inter-ethnic or inter-anything, conflict war in Iraq now, the civil war that was pretty much conflict, does not compare to Israel. And I personally do believe that Israel and the Palestinians are on a state on 67 borders, or at least equivalent.
But that's not Israel. That's occupied territory.
Yes,
that's
Israel.
That we are likely to descend into civil war. I understand that there are those who argue that we're in one now. Position I have taken publicly is that it really doesn't matter to me. I'm not interested in engaging in the academic exercise of what definition we are in. People are dying, we need to bring the killing to a stop. And this is the business that we are engaged in. And the circumstances that you find us in, the deals, the political deals we are trying to craft, are designed with that in mind. So, you have, for instance, on the question of oil, we have a hydrocarbon law which is now percolating its way through our parliament in an attempt equitably to distribute the revenues from the oil and to create a rational method of extracting the oil from the ground, understanding that the previous regime did tremendous damage to our oil fields. I'm not an expert on this, but we will have to develop new technologies to extract maximum amounts of oil because of the damage that the previous regime did to our oil fields. We are now extracting far more water than we should be at this stage of extraction. Our fields are too young to be getting the volume of water, the percentage of water that we're getting now. That will have to somehow be dealt with. In any event, so we are dealing with these problems in an attempt to avert the darker calamities. My interest is in making sure we're all pulling in the same direction, which is to avert more calamities in Iraq, rather than to promote discord and death in that country. Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming here today.
My pleasure.
So, I have a question more regards to the economics in Iran.
Listen, I can't balance a checkbook, but I'll do it anyway.
I'm going to have you. A lot of political scientists today say that the biggest threat to world stability is unemployed, hungry, jobless young men. And of course, a lot of people theorize that a lot of people who are contributing to the insurgency are just that, the young men who don't have a job for a handful of denarii just to feed their family or to be able to afford a roof over their head. They'll go out and place a bomb, or they'll give intelligence about U.S. troop movements, things like that. And a lot of people say it was a big error on the Bush administration's part to allow foreign contractors to come into Iraq afterwards to rebuild. And now they're trying to rectify that situation by, you know, trying to stimulate the Iraqi economy by hiring more Iraqis to start rebuilding the infrastructure of the country. And of course, at the same time, you see Al-Qaeda in Iraq is waging its own kind of economic war, similar to what Hezbollah has been doing in Lebanon, by trying to endear themselves to the Iraqi people by giving loans, housing widows and orphans and things like that.
Two very different things. Al-Qaeda has not opened any banks in Iraq. It's blowing up playgrounds and schools and hospitals and funerals. Two very different things. So keep Hezbollah on one side and Al-Qaeda on the other. Two very different phenomena. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Anyway, what kind of effect do you think the U.S. stimulating the Iraqi economy is going to have in the long run on achieving stability in the country and keeping young men from having young men being able to go get a great job and be good legal citizens instead of having to resort to assisting terrorism just to keep themselves, the belly full?
Well, I think you're hit upon a very important point. And one of the things that happened in Iraq immediately post-fall of the previous regime was exactly as you suggested, that even truck drivers were being hired to come in from Turkey and Jordan and other countries, rather than hiring Iraqi truck drivers to truck goods back and forth. And so that whereas ordinarily there's a multiplier effect, and this is about one of what I said about economics, of every dollar that you spend in a country, we had the opposite. There was no money, in fact, being spent in the country. And so while, people in our neighboring states became wealthier, there was no palpable effect inside the country. It was a huge mistake in my judgment. Obviously, that's something which we are attempting to recreate. To rectify. Not every word is a pearl. in any event, to rectify. and this is one of the things that we have done in cooperation with the United Nations in what is called the Iraq Compact, which is an attempt to promote the development of economic reconstruction, obviously fueled ultimately by our own revenues derived from the oil. But in the first instance, because the oil infrastructure is so greatly damaged through lack of maintenance over almost 30 years, though we are having to rely on donor contributions. But that is very much, your point is extremely well taken, and that is exactly what is, as I said, I think it also went with my earlier remarks, one of the sort of prongs of the attempt to get around this. And that's right, fundamentally, you know, we want to give people something else to do, another way of earning a living rather than setting off, explosive devices on the side of the road. Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Ambassador. The common notion that you hear nowadays on TV on any pundit's talk show is that Iran is trying to fight a proxy war with the United States and Iraq. And my question to you is, do many Iraqis feel as though Iran is trying to incite the violence? And how would you describe Iraq's diplomatic relationship with Iran? And what challenges do you see ahead in the future? Thank you.
Well, after 35 years of having an increasingly bellicose and belligerent and isolated and pariah state in Iraq, one of the things we're attempting to do is to reintegrate ourselves regionally and internationally. So to play a role that is appropriate for a country such as Iraq, which is to say not a role too small for us, as was the case when we were sort of isolated in a pariah state for too long, but on the other hand, not too large a role either in the manner that Saddam Hussein intended to play, but an appropriate role for us regionally and internationally. Our foreign policy is, there's an expression in Baghdadi Arabic, a thousand friends and no enemies. So our intent is very much to have good relations with all our neighbors to the extent possible. But on the other hand, I think very many of us also believe in the American expression, and I did grow up here in the Midwest, that strong fences make good neighbors.
Hi, thanks for coming. You said that a lot of the insurgents are what you call Iraqi nationalists, and that they want, what they want is for Iraq to not be partitioned. Now, given that we also want Iraq to not be partitioned, then why are we in a battle, seemingly in a battle, against these Iraqi nationalist insurgents for the same goal? And shouldn't we appoint them to take our job? And shouldn't they be fighting the Al-Qaeda and the Saddamists? Because like you said, you take care of your problems, I'll take care of mine. We have national problems in America that are being neglected because we're putting so much focus on Iraq. And I guess the question is, can't these Iraqi nationalist insurgents be doing the same thing that we're doing? And what do you see would be a realistic timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops?
Well, if the United States, with its, without a question, mightiest armed forces in the world, with all the technology at its disposal, with the finest training equipment, if it is having difficulty in combating the Saddamists and the Al-Qaeda, which I think we can agree that it appears to be having some difficulty, then how realistic is your expectation that the Iraqis will be successful? I would suggest to you that it is respectfully, and I understand the thrust of your question. And again, I've lived in this country, I was born in this country, and I understand there are problems here. Obviously, there are problems in every country. And I can also understand the sacrifice and blood and treasure this country has made in Iraq.
Of course, we effect of Saddam out of power, he caused the whole problem.
I beg your pardon?
He caused the whole problem too, I mean.
Well, no, I didn't say that. But, having gone to that trouble, I would suggest that there may be some ethical obligation to help us. Or at least someone could make that argument.
Mr. Easterbody, I wonder whether you status as a diplomat would allow you to express an opinion about what role is played by the strange dark character called Masad al-Assad in Iraq. What role does he play there? What's his game?
Well, it's an interesting question, and what I can say is that he has been, he's an interesting fellow actually, because his discourse has been in Iraq entirely one of, as in, he has spoken in his public efforts entirely as an Iraqi, and not as a Shia, despite what is often said about him. On the other hand, you know, the Americans and others in the Iraqi government have from time to time asserted that that one of the problems that we have is in respect to some of the militias which may or may not, by the way, be controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr. So he's a very complicated character. Comes from obviously a very distinguished family. His father was the Grand Ayatollah in Iraq before Sistani and was murdered by Saddam Hussein. In fact, his father was, or his two brothers. Yet, whatever role else he may play, he is also represents the head of a party which, although he himself is not in Parliament, he has 30 seats in Parliament. So there is, he's a complicated man who can probably play a productive role in the reconciliation process, and my hope is that he will do so.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Well, with all respect to my Lebanese friends, the last thing that I think most Iraqis want is the kind of sectarian divisions in Iraq that have been institutionalized, if not constitutionalized, in Lebanon. So that the president of Lebanon is always a Maronite Christian. The prime minister, I think, and I'll probably get this wrong, but the prime minister, I think, is always a Sunni. The president of the parliament is always a Shi'i, and different, you know, confessional groups get different positions in the cabinet. Before I was appointed as well, maybe I was already an ambassador, I guess I was. So after our first election in January of 1985, everyone assumed that my old boss, as I did again, my former boss, would contend for the presidency of Iraq. Adnan Pakhtunchi happens to be personally, well, his family happens to be Sunni. And so it was assumed that he would contest for the presidency of Iraq. And he was asked by Al Jazeera immediately after the election, you know, are you a candidate for president? His response was, we want to be very clear that in Iraq, there is no confessional requirement for any office. And because we have a history that the president of Iraq was assuming, and I'm quoting Dr. Bajic now, because we in Iraq have a history of the president of Iraq being assuming, I think it's important that the next president of Iraq not be a Sunni out there. And he endorsed Jalal Talabani for president, who you may know is a ethnically a Kurd, happens to be a Sunni as most Kurds are, but as many men are now. He endorsed him for president. And I think, Pasha, he probably spoke for most Iraqis, that we don't want this kind of institutionalization in our constitution, or in our, even if it's not constitutional, we don't want it institutionalized, number one. As far as the role of religion is concerned, that issue has in fact been resolved in the permanent constitution, that Islam is the religion of the state of Iraq. That has been true in Iraq since the first constitution of 1925, and it is probably true of every other Arab country, that there is some statement, and I don't know the country for a fact, but I would guess that from most Arab countries, there is some statement that, that Islam is the official religion of the state. And that it is also true that the permanent constitution states that there cannot be legislation which violates the agreed judgments of Islam, but it also states that there cannot be legislation that violate the principles of democracy and of the Bill of Rights, which is comparative to the liberal Bill of Rights in the permanent constitution. So it is, there is clearly an accommodation of Islam in our religion and in our constitution, but it is also true that in no way can Iraq be described as an Islamic republic, nor are its institutions similar in any degree, its government institutions similar in any way to some of our neighbors, whether Shia or Sunni. So it's kind of a mixed bag, I guess you'd say. Yes, sir.
As an exile yourself, would you say what are the most potentially dangerous or damaging effects of the Iraqi post-war conflict of people, refugees leaving and new exiles being created in both different either Arab countries or back in the United States? How do you think this affects the reconstruction effort that you're losing some of your best and brightest or your middle class, you know, who are running away from violence?
Well, as you're pointing out, we have what are known in international law as temporary displaced individuals. Who, as you correctly point out, are fleeing violence. Of course, it's always the case that the middle class, who are always the most educated in any country, have the ability to find refuge in other countries away from violence. It clearly is a fundamental problem. Obviously, the government is aware of that, and it is critical that this brain be reversed. We're very well aware of that. And it is an issue that is why attempting to get a handle on security is so fundamental. If we can't get a handle on security in the country, then very little else matters.
So the second part of my question is, to what effect are there being efforts other than security to keep middle-class people in?
Well, I mean, look, you know, on the one hand, you know, people are clearly seeking some respite from violence, so we're no longer, as the previous regime did, forcing people to stay. That clearly is not the answer. There are some who are displaced internally, and there are some who are displaced externally. There is an attempt to resolve the security problem, which is the root cause of why they left. You know, the Iraqis have a history. Other Arab states, particularly, for instance, you look at the Lebanese, have historically gone, for well over 100 years, you've had Lebanese immigrants to the United States, or the economic immigrants, just like any other immigrant group that came to this country for economic betterment. You don't have a history of that in Iraq. In Iraq, you have people who have fled tyranny. So in this case now, these are people who are fleeing the violence. If you're able to get a handle on the violence and provide security, and are able, therefore, to begin to speak in large terms about the economic reconstruction of the country, I believe that problem will be resolved.
So you say Baghdad is the key to Iraq. I believe that.
But then again, I'm from Baghdad, so I would say that. Of course, I guess I do believe that.
As Wilmington is the key to India.
Absolutely.
But amongst the American military, it's pretty well known that the Baghdad police force is infiltrated by the Mahdi militia in large portion, and that oftentimes when American soldiers come to Iraqis to hit targets that are Shia in nature, the phone call will come down and the Iraqi police will back out. And that kind of undermines our, we can't hit the target. We don't have the legitimacy. And since the Iraqi government is a sovereign power in Iraq, what are they doing to weed out the Mahdi militia in the Baghdad police?
Well, it isn't only the Americans that are aware of that. I mean, the government is also aware of that problem. And actually, right now, we have not discussed this at all. Unfortunately, this evening, you know, we haven't had a place for it, but the existence of the militias in Iraq, which have arisen largely in the last year, has been a really key problem in terms of security in Baghdad. I will tell you, and I can speak about this because it's a matter of historic record. When the Iraqi army and security forces were dissolved, in order number one by Ambassador Bremer, we went for many moons without an official, but without any Iraqi army or security services. When the plan was developed within the CDA, the Coalition for Iraq Authority, for the somebody in the CDA having trouble with the GMRE, for the
reconstitution,
thank you, of the Iraqi armed and security forces. I happen to be representing Dr. Bakhtiari on security today, and General Sanchez came in to announce to us that the security forces would be reconstituted by having the various political parties nominate the recruits. I know absolutely nothing about security, and I'm not that bright. But I piped up and said, you are causing the politicization of our armed and security services. I was admitted to you that history is proving you correct. And it is a problem that my government is profoundly aware of. We are in the process of attempting to address that. You have had whole units that have been disbanded for precisely that reason. And others that have not disbanded have been sent back for retraining. This is one of the problems of some of the hiccups that we have.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking my question. I've just got a few questions. What effect do you think that an increase in U.S. troops in Iraq would have, if any? How do you think this would be perceived in America, and what consequences do you think it could have?
Are you talking about the surge?
Yeah, the proposed troop surge.
The current surge is now underway.
I'm sorry, I was unaware of that.
Pardon me?
I was unaware of that, I'm sorry. But, there's, you know, McCain, for example, he advocated sending more troops, I think. Is that correct?
Well, I can talk about what's happening now, which is this surge of 20,000 or so, 22,000 troops. That is, of course, done in consultations between the government of Iraq and the government of the United States. And I think that the plan is to concentrate an increased force. Ordinarily, and I didn't realize this for a very long time, when you say that there are, let's say, 100, you know, American troops in a given location, that's not to say that there are 100 people carrying arms and patrolling the street, because you've got all sorts of logistics support. I'm no expert, you may be. I'm told that it's no more than 15 or 20% of people that may be carrying arms at any given time, of that 100. So that 100 people, you only have about 20 people that are actually out in the streets carrying arms. Everybody else is in some sort of support or logistical role. Whatever the numbers are, it is somewhat misleading to talk about 140,000 troops in Iraq, although there are that many. That's not to say that at any given moment there are 140,000 people in the streets carrying arms. What this planned surge does is to concentrate a very higher percentage, a very much higher percentage of people who do carry arms into Baghdad in an attempt to deal principally with the militias that we've talked about a little bit here, and as well as with some of the other insurgent elements in the capital and its environment. As far as what the Iraqi people are, what I can refer you to is a poll that was recently done by the British. But I'm not sure it actually was the BBC, it was obviously reported on by the BBC. In any event, that showed something like two-thirds of the Iraqis want the United States to stay until until security is established, and the peace and security develops from that. And what I would say, and there was some question about the timeline, and I'm not sure if you asked for something before you, but the point is, this has to be capacity-driven. It has to be in terms of the Iraqi people, the Iraqis themselves being able to do the things that the American forces are doing. And I can tell you, the Americans don't want to stay in Iraq any longer than they have to. And frankly, however, grateful the people of Iraq may be that the Americans removed the previous regime, nobody in the position of the Iraqi people wants the American forces there any longer than necessary. So we are very actively trying now to reposition ourselves, to be able to deal realistically with the security problem on our own. But that will take time. How long it takes?
One more
question, and there's one person.
No, I've got one more.
Well, you kind of had a couple. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I feel quite a bit of pressure to ask a question. I've heard a number of my everyday under Americans place a religious connotation upon our current involvement in Iraq. And I was wondering if being everyday Iraqi, just the random guy on the street, believes that the Americans have somehow religious motivation in being in the area, and how important you think religion is going to play in how the street sees our involvement.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. So let's see if you can make me understand the question. I mean, if the question is, do the Iraqis think that there's some messianic mission of the Americans wrong? The answer to that is no. I'm not sure that's what you asked, though. Am I getting close to it?
Somewhat.
What I think the Iraqi people know is this, that they were governed by a man who was responsible for having launched or gotten us into three groups. And over the course of 35 years in leadership, 25 years as president of Iraq, 24 years, managed to squander our wealth, kill off up to 2 million of us, not to mention at least 750,000 Iranians in the Iran-Iraq war, for absolutely no reason whatsoever. The Iraqis are profoundly aware, for instance, the 270 mass graves we've found so far, which contain the remains of 400,000 soldiers. And they're profoundly aware that if the United States had not acted, they had no hope that the next several decades would be any different than the previous few. Now, if someone wants to comfort himself by believing that he or she is the right hand of God, working justice in an otherwise unjust world, okay. What the Iraqis are interested in, I suspect, is what you're interested in, which is to live in a decent way.
do otherwise. And they have lived, which is a human condition. But the Iraqis are aware as a hope for the international effort to remove the previous regime, they have no hope of any of that. Beyond that, you know, every man in his conscience. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for attending tonight. I think we enjoyed that quite a bit. And on your way out, if you want to stop by one of the tables out there for student life, national security, or ISAC, there's information. But if we could, give Ambassador Gavadi another round of applause for the extraordinary.